Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the first teleclass of our March Novice Teleclass Series. This is the Principles of Disinfection, Antisepsis, and Chemical Sterilization Concepts and Controversies. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague and the co-founder of this teleclass education series, Dr. Syed Sattar, we are delighted to have you with us. Now, Syed Sattar is the founder and director of the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology at the University of Ottawa. And aside from the world-renowned research that comes from him and his center, he is also renowned for hiring the brightest and the best. Our speaker today is one of the really bright ones. Jason Tetreault is a researcher at the researcher and the resource manager at CREM. I've come to know Jason quite well, and I appreciate him more and more all the time. In fact, when somebody sends me a question that arises from a teleclass, specifically about disinfection, sterilization, antisepsis, that sort of thing, chances are that the answer that I send back to them originally came from Jason, although I take full credit for it invariably. He has authored or co-authored several published articles, and his research skills are truly outstanding. In his spare time, although I can't see that he has a whole heck of a lot of that, he is also an accomplished filmmaker. All that, and a nice guy too, imagine that. It's a great privilege to have him with us, and I will just close my opening comments by saying that from the research for from the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology at the University of Ottawa, I am pleased to present Jason Tetreault. JT.
Good afternoon from Ottawa, everyone. I'm very happy to be talking with you about something that we take extremely passionately here at the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology. And I guess we should just get right into it. So if we go from the first slide to the second slide, which is current status of pathogens, one of the reasons that we do take disinfection, antisepsis, and chemical sterilization so passionately is due to the fact that we have quite a number of pathogens, including some 1,400 that we know of. And of those 1,400 that we know of, there's probably about 200 that we still haven't really characterized very well. The number continues to grow, and in the last 30 years, we have some 300 new and emerging infectious diseases or infectious disease events that have occurred. And some of them you've probably heard of for good reasons because they've had some implications on the global scale. Back in 2003, we had the SARS epidemic, but it was possibly going to be a pandemic. We were very, very lucky in the fact that we stemmed that. We only had some 800 to 1,000 deaths as a result of SARS. Pandemic-wise, avian influenza, everybody has probably heard about this as our possible future pandemic. It's something that is hiding away, and we're expecting it to arrive one day or another. C. difficile, now this has become an endemic problem worldwide. Since 2002, when we first saw what was going on in Quebec with the NAP1027 strain, we've had unprecedented increases in prevalence, upwards of 5 to 10-fold worldwide. And quite honestly, many hospitals have gotten to the point where it is endemic. And we are seeing an increase or a rise of C. difficile in the community. Therefore, it's something that's going to be very difficult. When you look at VRE, MDRX, TB, what I'm talking about here is essentially the fact that we're seeing an increase in antibiotic resistance, leaving many researchers and also people within the healthcare establishment with very few to no options. Therefore, if I may be so bold as to say, in a post-antibiotic era, we should be focusing on the need to prevent the spread and minimize the prevalence of infectious diseases rather than scrambling to try and find methods to respond to infections. Now, if you turn to the next slide, the breakdown of known human pathogens, I'm just presenting this to give an idea as to where we're seeing pathogens coming out. Helminths, even though account for 20%, I'm not very much going to go into in this lecture. I'm going to focus on pathogens that have a relevance to environmental spread, perhaps in focusing a little bit more on healthcare facilities, but also in environments such as the home and such. And as you can see, 38% of the pathogens that we know of are bacteria, 15% of them are viruses, and we're including prions in here because essentially prions do make up their own proteinaceous group. However, they fit nicely in this graph. We have 22% that are fungi and 5% that are protozoa. The breakdown essentially allows us to look a little bit deeper into each of the different types of pathogens. So if you turn to the next slide, which is bacteria. Bacteria are extremely ubiquitous in numerous environmental settings. They're we have gram-positive bacteria, and names that you're familiar with are Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, Bacillus. We have gram-negative bacteria. The Escherichia, Pseudomonas, and Salmonellas are part and parcel there. From a disinfection or prevention of spread, they are generally easy to kill with disinfection and sepsis. However, one of the things that we have to be concerned about is biofilms. A biofilm contains a polysaccharide layer called the glycocalyx that allows bacteria to hide away if we're trying to disinfect. And quite honestly, it also shelters the bacteria from other kinds of environmental stressors. This actually allows bacteria to gain resistance and also to gain the ability to withstand numerous different environments. One of the things that I found most interesting in my past was that there was a bacterium that was left in a silver solution in an electron microscopy laboratory. And what happened is that over time, they decided not to sterilize the solution for numerous reasons. And eventually they found that this bacteria not only became resistant to silver with time, it actually became dependent on silver. And many of you have probably heard of the antibiotic-dependent bacteria, which essentially cannot survive without the use of antibiotics. Well, this is one of the ways that this occurs. I should also mention that with bacteria, one of the issues that we have with respect to disinfection and antisepsis is the idea that because they are so ubiquitous, when you actually touch a clean surface just with your bare hands, you can be leaving anywhere between 500 and 1,000 colony-forming units or bacteria behind. So quite honestly, the idea of completely cleaning a surface for an extended period of time is not something that really can happen in a true setting where you do have people touching things on a regular basis. So this is something that you must consider as we move forward in this discussion, that no matter how much we talk about disinfection, antisepsis, and cleaning, the idea that you can touch something and recontaminate it almost immediately must be present. All right, moving to the next slide. Bacteria have a group within their levels called mycobacteria. These are a different group of bacteria than gram-positive and gram-negative. In actual fact, if you were to do bacteriological staining, they would be stained as gram-neutral. Mycobacteria, the famous one, of course, is Mycobacterium tuberculosis. However, more recently, we've been focusing on non-tuberculosis bacteria, environmental. Some names that you've probably heard of include the Mycobacterium avium complex, which is extremely important in individuals who are immunosuppressed with HIV. There is something called MAP, which is Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis, which has been seen as being one of the possible associative causes for Crohn's disease. And then there's something called hypersensitivity pneumonitis, which is essentially is an inflammation of the lung due to hypersensitivity or essentially an allergy. Mycobacterium is potentially a cause for that. Mycobacteria are very difficult to kill because they have a very thick cell wall, which contains mycolic acid and other components. As a result of this, they are slow and hard to grow in the lab because they need the time to be able to grow this very thick wall. And the other thing is that as a result of this slow growth and also higher resistance, they're extremely important in the development of biofilms. And one of the things that we're finding is that even in drinking water, we're noticing that these non-tuberculosis or environmental mycobacteria can be found in various potable water sources. For people who are not immunocompromised, there's absolutely no problem. But for people who are immunocompromised, there are issues to be considered. Moving on to bacterial spores. These are produced by certain types of gram-positive bacteria known as the Bacillus, the Clostridium. There are a number of others. Spores survive well in the environment and withstand pretty much any kind of environmental stressor. In fact, as you probably know, if you're going to actually destroy spores, you'd have to use 121 degrees Celsius with 15 pounds per square inch of pressure, otherwise known as autoclaving. Clostridium difficile, as I mentioned before, is an important pathogen. However, you've probably also heard of tetanus and anthrax. These two are also caused by spore formers. And one other that you may have heard of is Bacillus, or now it's commonly known as Geobacillus stereothermophilus, which is a common bioindicator for testing the efficacy of autoclaves and other sterilization components. Moving on to the next is viruses. Viruses are obligate parasites, which means that they cannot live on their own. They need to be able to infect another cell. And if you look at the picture, you'll see norovirus, which is a classic example of a non-enveloped virus, and influenza virus, which is a classic example of an enveloped virus. Enveloped viruses have a lipid envelope. Therefore, from a disinfection perspective, they are much easier to kill. And the fact is that a non-enveloped virus is going to be difficult to kill primarily because they have a tightly organized protein, as I've mentioned in the slide. However, what that means is that they have a receptor binding region of protein, and that is usually highly conserved, and it's also very, very difficult to disrupt. So therefore, if you cannot disrupt the receptor binding domain or region of a non-enveloped virus, you're not going to be able to inactivate the virus, and then it's just going to continue going on. So from that perspective, non-enveloped viruses, we know how to do it. It's just, it's very difficult to do under regular circumstances. In terms of fungi, the next slide. I only want to bring this up because there are some fungi problems that we are noticing, primarily Aspergillus. This is an infection that occurs in immunocompromised individuals, and it seems to be as a result of the fact that there's a ubiquity of this particular fungus in healthcare facilities, and many papers have shown that this can be actually dated back to construction. So in terms of fungus, you are dealing with something that could be ubiquitous within a facility without having actually been brought in by any patients or healthcare workers. It's one of those few things that is there, and you're not going to be able to get rid of it. Normal and healthy individuals can prevent growth. However, immunocompromised people can be colonized, and then eventually they can develop a problem. Sick building syndrome is one of these things. Again, hypersensitivity pneumonitis I've talked about. And for those of you who are wondering, Candida albicans is actually a fungus that can cause problems. Again, it's a colonization factor. However, for immunocompromised individuals, it can be a problem. Moving on to protozoa. Protozoa do cause only a small percentage of problems. However, these microscopic single-celled animals cause gastrointestinal problems that can be highly burdensome on individuals. Acanthamoeba causes eye infections and can also lead to meningitis forms. And then we have Toxoplasma gondii, which again causes an infection in pregnant women and other individuals. The oocysts of protozoa are extremely difficult to inactivate, and therefore, if you're going to be doing any type of disinfection or antisepsis procedure, just realize that for the most part, if you have oocysts, which are essentially one of the complex life cycle of the protozoa, you're not going to be able to remove that, and therefore you're going to have to look at doing other higher regimen disinfection antisepsis practices. In other words, normal disinfection, cleaning, antisepsis is not going to work. You have to go to a higher level. I'm just going to mention a quick word about prions. They have caused a huge problem in Britain and to some extent in the United States due to the fact that a new variant CJD came out back in the 80s, and this had a minor amino acid substitution that allowed it to become extremely, extremely infectious. And therefore, if you were to get a prion in your blood, or in your body through consumption. It would go into your blood, it would go into your brain, it would nucleate, and then you would go through what is known as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which essentially is the formation of plaques within the brain. It is fatal, so therefore you want to absolutely prevent its ability to be spread. The problem is that it's considered to be one of the hardest to inactivate, and other than using 134 degrees Celsius for 18 minutes, 121 degrees Celsius for 30 minutes, now this is heat drying, heat sterilization, or one normal sodium hydroxide for 15 minutes, you couldn't get rid of it. There was a paper in 2004 that talked about enzymatic cleaners and phenolic disinfectants working. However, this has yet to be completely proven, and therefore I would still recommend that for prion sterilization purposes are the only thing that we can use. So now that we've gone through some of the pathogens, I just want to bring up the next slide, which is interrupting the environmental spread of pathogens, by showing that a pathogen essentially has to go through a number of steps in order for us to get a disease. Essentially, the pathogen has to somehow contaminate an environment. It has to survive in the environment. It has to transfer within the environment to something that we're going to touch. And then it has to go through one of the portals of entry, i.e. absorption through the skin or mucous membranes, ingestion and or inhalation. And then it has to somehow cause disease. Now, disease can only be caused if you have enough of that particular infectious agent inside of you, otherwise known as a minimal effective dose, or if you are immunocompromised and therefore there is no immune system to prevent you from being able to stop the disease. Regardless, the whole point of doing disinfection, antisepsis, and sterilization is to interrupt the potential for inoculation. So as we move forward, just realize that that broken line is really the goal or the objective of everything that we're going to be talking about from now on. I've put together a few definitions based on what some people have been concerned about in the past. A chemical sterilant, which of course is chemical sterilization, is something that is essentially a process whereby you're killing all life using a chemical. However, one must understand that in order for us to completely remove life from an environment, we cannot think about simply area. We have to think about volume. And as a result of that, a chemical sterilant can really only be regarded as being a gas or something that's in a gaseous or vapor form. So when we get to that a bit later on, please keep that in mind. Decontamination is a term that people use but sometimes don't quite understand. Decontamination is either a physical or a chemical process to remove or inactivate microbes to safe levels. You can use disinfection and still be doing decontamination. You can be doing sterilization and you can still be doing decontamination. So essentially, decontamination is the big objective. And how you get around that is the procedure. And again, this is where you have either cleaning, disinfection, antisepsis, sterilization. Load is interfering material that will challenge an active. And in this particular case, I've just included the three loads that people would use. Soil load, which is, of course, organic and inorganic material. Organic load, which is what most people use when they're actually challenging an active. And this is a combination of different organic materials. There's also bioburden, in which you're going to only be using organisms, whether they be alive or they be dead. I'll get to that in a little bit further. I just want to bring that up. Microbicide. Now, everyone's heard of the term germicide, I'm sure, and disinfectants and antiseptics and such. We like to generalize all of those terms into one, which is called microbicide, which essentially is it's killing microbes. If you get into the habit of using the term microbicide, that's great. Finally, test protocol. We're going to get into this again. However, this is a specific method that you use to challenge an antimicrobial agent against a specific microbe. And the reasons that you do that is that you want to make sure that what you've chosen to use in your environment is going to be effective. Now, before I get into the principles of disinfection and antisepsis, I just want to quickly mention the fact that a disinfectant is for decontamination of surfaces, whereas an antisepsis is for decontamination of skin and mucous membranes. It's very straightforward. However, when you get to the next perspective, which is the consideration of your target, you have to realize that there are three major issues to consider, and that is the claim. In other words, what is this act of killing or inactivating? The physical environment, which is where are we going to use this particular disinfectant or antisepsis? And again, a surface cannot just simply be a surface. A surface could be stainless steel or it could be plastic. So we'll get into that. The microbial resistance, in other words, how strong is the target organism against the active that we're using? Do we have to use more? Can we use less? And then, of course, the application environment, in other words, objects, frequently touched surfaces, skin. We know that when you're using a frequently touched surface, you want to be doing cleaning and disinfection on a much more regular basis. However, this is, of course, dependent on other factors, which I'm not going to get into, such as economics and budgets. Moving on to choosing a product. What I have here is I actually have a label that was put out by the Center for Food Security and Public Health at Iowa State University. They actually have a description of what a label looks like. I'm just putting this up here to show people that a label is extremely compact and it has a lot of information. And in many ways, it's very, very difficult to interpret everything on a first go. You have to take some time to be able to take a closer look at a label and try and figure out exactly what you're looking at. And if you look at the next slide, which is called Looking At and Past the Labels, you realize that a label is going to be highly regulated. When you have that much information in such a small space, you know that they're going to have to strictly adhere to a particular breakdown. And that breakdown, again, is at that Center for Food Security and Public Health website. Now, based on extensive testing of the active in the laboratory environment, a label is going to say that we performed this kind of testing and therefore we came up with this type of result and therefore we can claim it against a particular organism. The only problem is that when you read a label, there are some statements that are made that could cause some problems. Now, here are some examples. If you were to read a label for a disinfectant, that it's supposed to be diluted in water. This actually means distilled water. However, in the field, most people would use tap water. If you were to use tap water, then the claim that is made is no longer valid. A contact time is mentioned. If you were to read the contact time for some disinfectants, it would say 10 minutes. However, a contact time may actually be only a few seconds when you're actually applying it. So you have to be very cautious about how you're using your disinfectant and whether or not the way or the application of the use actually reflects what is on the label. Finally, you have separate dilutions or different dilutions, and this is something that's very difficult because if you have a number of different products but only one active, one might have 1 ppm, one might have 1,000 ppm, another one might have 1,000,000 ppm. That's going to be fine, but what you get in real life is one disinfectant with a huge concentration, and then it tells you to do separate different dilutions for killing bacteria or killing mycobacteria. So therefore, you have to know what dilution you're going to use for what purpose that you're going to use, and then sometimes that can be very difficult without proper training. Now, I mentioned about claims a few times, and just to bring it up very quickly, claims are validated against various test methods, and they are standardized. At CREM, we've actually developed a couple of these test methodologies as well. The method that has to be used is actually dependent on where you're going to be using it. So if it's in Europe, you have to use European Union standardization methods. If you're using it in Canada or the US, you can use an AOAC method or an ASTM method. More recently, methods are trying to be harmonized through our laboratory. However, that is ongoing and probably won't happen for another year. The next thing I have here is if you're looking at the actual activities themselves or the claims themselves, if you're looking at sporicidal, mycobactericidal, and bactericidal activity, the product is known within the contact time at the dilution used to kill 6 log or 1 million fold. Viricidal activity, at the proper contact time, at the proper dilution, you're going to reduce it by 3 log. Fungicidal activity, again, proper dilution, proper contact time, it's going to be reduced by 5 log. And the reason that I said what I've said with respect to dilution and contact time is if you were to look at testing a claim, you're looking at the different levels of the active. And this is what I was talking about, is if you were to look at hypochlorite, 1 ppm is actually pretty good for maintaining water at a particular level. However, if you're going to be disinfecting a surface that is contaminated with a number of different bacteria, including mycobacteria, well, then you're going to have to use 1 to 5,000 ppm. So how do you dilute a standard bucket of bleach or a standard bottle of bleach properly to be sure that you're doing what you want to do? The same can be said with peroxide and also with ethanol, which I'll get into a little later. You have protocol issues. The test methodology that was used may actually not reflect what you're trying to do. A classic example is that a number of disinfectants have a claim against a particular organism through what is known as a suspension test. A suspension test is where you take 1 mL of your test organism and then you add it to 9 mL of your active disinfectant. The thing is that is a highly unreasonable test when it comes to using something as a disinfectant on a surface. We at CREM have developed carrier tests where you're actually using 10 microliters of a particular organism and you're putting that with 50 microliters of your test active disinfectant. This one is a lot more similar and seems to have a much better relation with actual application. And in terms of antiseptics, most antiseptics are now moving towards this, but in the past, we've actually seen what they call in vitro or carrier testing to reflect skin. However, more and more people are now using skin-based tests or in vivo testing in order to prove that their product works. We do that here at CREM using what is known as a finger pad test, and that just entails taking the 10 microliters, putting it on the finger instead of onto a surface, and then performing similar tests. Continuing with issues of testing claims, this is what I was talking about with load. What load was used and does it relate to the intended environment? If you are intending on using a disinfectant in an environment where there's quite a bit of bodily fluids, the soil or the load that was used should probably reflect those bodily fluids. If, of course, you're doing a disinfection in a kitchen where food is being made, it should be reflecting what is being used in a kitchen as opposed to bodily fluids. So again, the soil load that was used should be looked at to make sure that it reflects the environment you're using for your disinfectant. The diluent. Again, I've mentioned this just briefly, but in what solution should the product be diluted? Because most of the time it's distilled water. So if you're seeing a claim that says water, you have to assume distilled water because that's what testings call for. You could test in hard water. You could test in sterile water. You could test in tap water. But then you start looking at conditions that are going to be different for each different kind of test. So unfortunately, from a testing perspective, only using one particular kind of diluent is the best, even though they understand that out in the field, you're never going to get that type of similarity. Manual pre-cleaning. I mention this because if you look at number of labels, you're going to see that they request you to be doing manual pre-cleaning before you use the disinfectant if there's heavy soiling or heavy contamination. This is absolutely wonderful in some environments where specific cleaning procedures are used. However, is the cleaning going to be compatible, not in terms of whether it works or not, but in terms of the time and resources that you have in order to be able to carry out a disinfection or a decontamination procedure. So therefore, if manual pre-cleaning is required prior to use, but there's really no ability to do that type of cleaning, then really is that product the best for you? I mentioned at the very bottom here, fresh versus reusable. This comes down to the fact that certain products do have shelf lives, and as a result of that, you should be making sure that when you're using it, it's actually within the shelf life. And if you continually have to be replacing it, then really is that actually a cost benefit to you? Physical factors. I've mentioned three major physical factors here that have direct implications with disinfection and antisepsis. You could write books and chapters on each one of these, so I'm just going to go through them very quickly and then we can continue on. With pH, all microbicides have specific pH optimum levels. I mentioned here that bleach or hypochlorite is best active below pH 5.0. Aldehydes, on the other hand, such as glutaraldehyde, is much better at a higher pH, such as pH of 8.0. So you need to focus on the environment and exactly what is the pH going to be. Bodily fluids, not a problem. You're looking at physiological pH. You're okay. Food, on the other hand, the pH might be different. Is there going to be any other contaminating agents? And if so, what are the pHs going to be there? In terms of temperature, activity should be optimal at room temperature for disinfection. For antiseptics, activity should be optimal at skin temperature, which is approximately 33 degrees Celsius. Just to give you a range of ideas, 4 degrees Celsius, there's very little function with a lot of disinfection antiseptic agents. However, if you increase that temperature to room temperature, they're usually extremely good, and many actually have optimal temperatures in the 40 to 50 degrees Celsius range. So again, if you're using something that is good or is useful for you at room temperature, even though its optimal activity is at 40 to 50 degrees, it might be something to consider. Relative humidity. I've just put this here because we've done testing in our laboratory, and it's pretty straightforward. Envelope viruses prefer the lower RH as relative humidity. Non-envelope viruses prefer the higher relative humidity. Bacteria, fungi prefer higher relative humidity. And spores can survive under almost any relative humidity. The optimal range of use should be between 40 and 60% simply because that's what we as humans prefer. If it's too dry, we know that and we're not very happy. If it's too wet, we feel clammy and we're just not happy either. So 40 to 50 is usually very nice for humans, and that's what you should be looking for. Moving on to microbial resistance. I've talked about this a little bit when I went through the actual pathogens themselves. What is really necessary to understand is what is the resistance of the organism you're trying to target? And do you have a good enough knowledge of that target organism to say that the use of this active is going to be proper to inactivate or to kill this particular target organism? Again, you must also consider biofilms. If you're looking at the potential for biofilms, you're going to have to go up a bit higher in terms of your active because of the resistance. What we like to say is that don't go general in terms of what you want to kill. Find the highest level of pathogen that you want to kill and then go to that level. And you're always going to be able to err on the side of caution. Because quite honestly, if you're using a little bit more product, if you're cleaning a couple more times than what is actually necessary, that's going to come out much better for you in the end than to have an infection, no matter where that is. I've put in words the resistance can be generalized. However, if you go to the next slide, you can see my words actually in a chart. And in terms of resistance, vegetative bacteria and envelope viruses are the easiest to kill. Fungi are more difficult to kill. However, that is not as bad as the mycobacteria and the non-envelope viruses. On top of that, you have bacterial spores and the protozoan cysts. And again, as I mentioned, when it comes to protozoan cysts, you have to go to the highest level of disinfection in order to get rid of them. Whether spores or cysts are hardier than the other is not a really big issue. The fact is that you're going to have to, as I said earlier, go to the sterilization technologies in order to get rid of them. And in terms of disinfection level, you see cold sterilization, high, intermediate, and low. And if you actually go to the next slide, I've just quickly outlined what they are. So you have a cold sterilant, which kills all organisms and ensures sterility. You have a high-level disinfectant, which kills all organisms except high levels of spores. Intermediate-level disinfectant, this is where you have the mycobacteria, most of the viruses, and bacteria, and in this case, Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And low-level disinfectant, which essentially is just there to kill basic enveloped viruses and bacteria. If you were going to be doing generalized cleaning, you would probably want to use a low-level disinfectant. If you're doing something a little bit more rigorous and you know that there's the potential for mycobacteria and or biofilms, you'll be looking at intermediate-level disinfection. High-level disinfection is really where you need to clean something to the point that you are removing all the spores, all the organisms, except perhaps for prions and cysts. Medical devices usually require high-level disinfection if they're going to be reused. And again, cold sterilization is just something that when you need that sterility, that's what you have to use. Other factors in choosing an active, I'm just going to go through this quickly. Materials compatibility. Some actives are going to have incompatibility charts. You should know that, because if your disinfection agent somehow reacts with one of the surfaces or one of the objects that you're trying to disinfect, you're not going to be anywhere ahead. Dosage and rate of application. As I mentioned, the number of times that you're cleaning or disinfecting is very important. What also needs to be considered at this stage is whether or not a disinfection process is going to be leaving residual films or layers, and whether or not those films or layers have activity, and if not, will they lead to biofilms? And if they lead to biofilms, then again, you're not really helping yourself. So if you can find something that wipes clean and doesn't leave a residue, then that's fabulous. Training and ease of use. Who's going to do the work? And also, what is it going to take to be able to use it? And in this case, I'm looking at something such as housekeeping versus infection control practitioners. If housekeeping is going to be doing all of the work for disinfection, they have to be using something that they're familiar with and that whatever training is available gets them to the level that they can use it. Whereas if it's an infection control practitioner, well, they already have that training, so they can use actives that are a little bit more dangerous or required more controlled use. And then that sort of lies into safety of personnel and environment. And again, personal protective equipment, risk analysis of odor, environmental pollution, exposures, all of these come into play. Moving on to list of actives, I've put on most of the general information such as chemical structure, activity, what they're good against, and claims that are known for the active. And I'm going to focus more on any controversies or issues with respect to the use of these particular chemicals, simply because reading about what they are and what they do is interesting. However, I think for this particular course, we should really have an idea as to what we should be thinking about when we hear about these particular actives. Moving on to chlorine. Essentially, chlorine is the widest used microbicide, and it's not going to go anywhere. In fact, we're now starting to see new chlorine-containing strategies coming out. Our water has chlorine in it. A number of disinfection agents have chlorine in it. And quite honestly, it's probably the world's best-known disinfectant. And this comes from the fact that I knew someone who was talking about being in Africa, and he walked into a general store in the middle of nowhere, and there were quite a number of things that he couldn't find, but he sure could find that bleach. Chlorine is always going to be there, and it's always going to be your friend, because at the right concentration, chlorine will pretty much eliminate all of your problems. In terms of bleach being most common, that's true, but you're also going to hear about chlorine dioxide, monochloramine, and some other chlorine-containing components, such as haloamines or organic halides. Essentially, people are changing chemical structure to increase the ability of chlorine to act. It's going to be very interesting, actually, in the future to see where chlorine goes. Phenols, on the other hand, are phenolics, and I've included the structures of triclosan and p-chloroamsilanol, otherwise known as Dettol. If you've ever seen or smelt Dettol, that's the component that you're smelling. It's been around since probably the 1700s, on and off. However, more recently, it's become a problem simply because the phenolic does have some toxicity associated with it. The other thing is that out in the environment, there are some issues with breaking down targets that shouldn't be broken down. And also the fact that triclosan, which is a phenolic, has been widely used. However, we don't believe that its use has really given us any benefit. In fact, one of the problems that we've seen is that triclosan resistance has come about in the environment, and that the more that we continue to use triclosan, the more likely we are to see resistance. So from the triclosan perspective, if you can get something without it, the better. In terms of the other phenols, you're going to see them in lozenges like resorcinol. You're going to see them in the Dettols, and you're going to see them in a number of other environments. We're not going to be getting rid of them anytime soon. However, if you are looking at a product for disinfection and or antisepsis, put phenolic a little bit further down the list, because I can guarantee you there are much better options. And the same can be said for surfactants, because surfactants, and what you see here is acetylpyridium chloride, they're a very interesting group. in the sense that they have a hydrophilic end and a hydrophobic end. And they're very, very good at disrupting envelopes, lipid layers, and they also help to disrupt proteins. The problem is that they are not particularly good at inactivating non-envelope viruses. They're not particularly good against mycobacteria, and they have absolutely no activity against spores. So you're going to be using this particular product out into the general environment. You're not going to be killing a number of potentially harmful agents, and then when it gets into the environment, it doesn't degrade extremely well, so it's leaving quite a bit of environmental footprint. You've probably heard of the term quaternary ammonium compounds. These particular quaternary ammonium compounds are pretty much everywhere, and they're being used in cleaning and disinfection routines, and as a result of that, I don't see this going away. However, for the future, again, QACs or quaternary ammonium compounds, put that a bit further down the list because, as I said, there are better options. Aldehydes used to be the gold standard for disinfection. Glyceraldehyde, I remember some 15, 20 years ago, that was the only thing that we would use when it came to bloodborne infections. You would always use 2% glyceraldehyde. However, toxicity, PPE, odor issues, and essentially cost issues, because glyceraldehyde has a very short shelf life, became major concerns. And so you started to see less use of this particular aldehyde. Now, in the recent past, there's been a new aldehyde called orthophthalaldehyde. It has been showing much better activity. However, it's still toxic like glyceraldehyde, just at a much lesser level. And yet, you're still going to have to use controlled conditions with proper training. So all the same issues with glyceraldehyde will appear with orthophthalaldehyde. And just very quickly, I mentioned formaldehyde simply because people still believe that formaldehyde is a very good agent for disinfection. It's a fixative agent, and in terms of disinfection, you don't want to be using it. There's too many issues with health and safety, and you're not getting the benefits. Metals. Metals work in a dose-dependent action. All metals are going to be toxic at high doses. Then again, water is going to be toxic at a high dose. So it's just a matter of finding out what is going to work. And what has been found is that two particular metals have come sort of out into the open and shown themselves to be very good agents for disinfection. The first one is copper. And in the United States, it is now actually registered as an official antimicrobial surface. So you have a surface of copper, and I've given you a little bit of insight as to how copper works to inactivate pathogens. However, one of the major problems is that copper also can be oxidized. And if you're using an oxidizing agent, it's going to be incompatible with copper unless there is an alloy that is used. And if you use an alloy, it may reduce the efficacy of copper. So even though it seems to be something that you're going to hear of, it's still very much debated. Silver, on the other hand, is widely used. Silver nitrate is very well known to interact with membranes and DNA, and it's being used not only as an antiseptic, but many of you have probably heard about it being used in textiles. It's going to be continuing on. However, with its increased popularity comes increased regulation, and this is one of the things that you need to think about, and that is silver compounds that will be coming out are going to be looked at in a much more stringent way by regulatory agencies. So you may end up using a silver compound now, but perhaps there might be a shortage of that in the future. Again, this is something that's with the regulatory people. However, if it were up to me, I would probably avoid silver until all the issues have been dealt with. Now, I've been saying that there was going to be a much better option coming, and this is the one. Hydrogen peroxide is going to be the future of disinfection. We have done studies with hydrogen peroxide for a number of years here at CREM, and it is by far one of the best disinfection agents that we know of. From a chemistry perspective, it produces free radicals. Those free radicals damage cells, and it targets absolutely everything. It's not just lipids, it's not just proteins, it's everything. And The very nice thing is that much like chlorine, you can actually change the concentration and change its ability to work. So you could be using a 0.5% hydrogen peroxide solution, and it's going to have a very nice general activity against bacteria and envelope viruses. Bring that up to 7.5%, it's now sporicidal, and it's going to take care of everything below it. From that perspective alone, you have something that's comparable to chlorine and is going to be heads above everything else. What makes it better, however, is the fact that it wipes away free, there's no residue, and there's very little potential for harm to humans. You can use this at much higher levels without any problems with inhalation, with absorption, and also potentially with ingestion, because if you were to ingest these levels, water would actually be the ability to make sure you do not have adverse events. The other very nice thing about it, as I've mentioned, is the fact that you can include hydrogen peroxide with a number of different types of preservatives, and then this makes the peroxide have a longer shelf life with the same amount of activity. I've included parasitic acid as well. The reason I've included that is because as a high-level disinfection agent, parasitic acid is just essentially one step higher than hydrogen peroxide. However, as a result of it being one step higher, it is highly corrosive and must be used under controlled conditions. However, in the same way, there's no residue, it's environmentally safe, and it kills. Alcohols. They do have a disinfection property, and they can be used as a disinfection or as a after-cleaning event, say in a laboratory. However, when we talk about alcohols these days, we're looking at antisepsis. One of the things that you should know is that when it comes to alcohol, waterless hand rubs are going to be the future. Whereas peroxide was the future for disinfection, waterless hand rubs that contain alcohol look to be the future for hand antisepsis. As that is the case, you have two choices. You have ethanol and you have isopropanol. Now, ethanol is extremely good because, as we've shown in the laboratory, it's wide-spectrum microbicide. It will kill bacteria. It will kill viruses. It won't kill spores. However, it is going to be one of the better ways to prevent regular run-of-the-mill infections, such as the cold, such as bacterial sepsis, MRSA, all those things. The only thing that you won't be able to use alcohol for is C. difficile. I also should mention that when it comes to ethanol, there is a concern with respect to use, and that is that you have a number of choices. Now, we're going to be putting out a paper later this year to show that effective denaturation and inactivation of non-envelope viruses is best at 62%. Now, if you remember, non-envelope viruses were up there in terms of the resistance. So if you can kill non-envelope viruses, then you're pretty much killing everything else better. And we're going to show that 62% is actually much better than 80%. This is probably going to go against the World Health Organization. However, I thought I'd mention it to you now, and then you can watch the fireworks from the debates. Moving on to cold sterilization, I know I only have about 7 minutes left, but there's only a couple more slides. Only three are approved by the FDA for cold sterilization, and the reason is that you could probably put a number of different chemicals such as aldehydes, probably phenolics, into the air, and I'm sure that those would actually end up helping to inactivate and or clean or disinfect an environment. However, since we're not looking at simply a surface area, we are looking at a volume, we have to be sure that we're using a gas or a vapor that is not only going to kill, much like these others would, but also we can aerate it out. We can get it out of there without much or any residue. And the three that have been chosen by the FDA through testing are ethylene oxide, ozone, and my favorite, hydrogen peroxide. Now, cold sterilization requires highly controlled environments, regardless of the three. Right now, if you were to do a room with any one of those three, you wouldn't be able to stay in there more than a few seconds, and I'm going to discuss that in a minute. However, more recently, we're starting to see autoclave-like models that sterilize medical devices within the hospital environment using one of these three particular agents. So cold sterilization has found a new life in a highly controlled small environment. That being said, we're still seeing room sterilization through these routes. We have a level 3 facility here at the university, and we're currently using hydrogen peroxide for that sterilization. I also mentioned that only trained individuals may work with cold sterilants, but again, if you have to use a highly controlled environment, you expect that people need to be trained. Moving on to the next slide, I'll just say that right now, ozone, which is fantastic as a cold sterilant, is also being used at very, very low part per billion concentrations as an air quality assurance chemical. And you can actually go out and buy this. So ozone itself is a very strong oxidizer. It's very good at cleaning the air. It leaves a very nice scent behind at those part per billion levels. However, if you're in the PPM levels that are required for sterilization, it is very highly toxic. So again, controlled settings are fantastic, but if you're going to be anywhere near the ozone, it's a problem. Ethylene oxide is sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. Whereas ozone is your oxidizer, this is the alkylator, which makes it even more toxic because it leaves a residue and it requires quite a bit of aeration time in order for you to be able to get it out. The other major issue is that if you are going to be using it, you have to use upwards of 1,500 parts per million. And since a human can only take a couple of ppm before the body starts to react negatively, it's one of those things where there's a lot of benefit, but you're probably going to be able to find much better benefit somewhere else. And that's where the gaseous hydrogen peroxide comes in, which is the next slide. In the hydrogen peroxide, whether it be in a liquid or it be in a gaseous form, is going to do exactly what I talked about earlier. One of the nice things about it is that you only need less than 10 ppm. You're going to be having good activity against all sorts of microorganisms. Yes, it needs to be under controlled settings, and yes, we do have to ensure that people are trained and safe. However, unlike the ethylene oxide and unlike the ozone, the requirement for aeration is less. There are no residues. And the other thing is that if a person does find themselves in an environment where there's a higher hydrogen peroxide concentration, the easiest way to bring them back to normal is to give them some water and also give them some fresh air. Whereas with the others, you would most likely have to use medical attention. The second to last slide is just an overview of activities. And all I'm saying here is that if you were to look at the different components or the different actives that I've gone through, and especially something like hypochlorite and peroxide, where I've included two different concentrations, you can actually see what the activity is like. And again, alkyne glutaraldehyde, quaternium ammoniums, phenolics, we want you to keep those at low on your list. Look at the hypochlorites or the chlorines. Look at the peroxides as being your first options if you're going to be looking at getting a disinfection. And when it comes to alcohol, 62% is what you want for proper antisepsis. Last thoughts, and this goes back to what I said at the very, very beginning. Disinfection and antisepsis and sterilization are tools to help us prevent spread of pathogens. However, infectious disease is one of those great problems that we have in facing our humanity today. And even though we have tools to help, it is going to be our own sense of hygiene, our own sense of community, and our own sense of infection control that is going to ultimately help us to prevent infection. So be diligent to prevent pathogen spread, preferably without having to resort to these, but if absolutely necessary, then go through these routes. And most of all, be sure that you maintain good hygiene. And I've just included two quotes at the end, which I think sum up exactly how I feel about this, which is hygiene is 2/3 of our health. 9/10 of our sickness can be prevented by right thinking plus right hygiene. And I think with that, we shall conclude this class.
Jason, thank you very much. Every time I ask you to talk, you are a little bit controversial, and I knew that going in.
I was just trying to stay on time.
That's good. See, the article that you published, that you're going to publish on the 62% alcohol, where will that be published and when?
Right now, we are looking at publishing this in The Lancet. We are currently in discussions with them. When we have a better understanding as to when it's going to come out, we'll be sure to let you know.
Appreciate that. I think you may get some letters to the editor on that one. But
we're counting on it, believe me.
I'm glad to see that you're not afraid to put out that kind of research. Thank you. And you also mentioned the quantitative carrier test that CREM has developed. I will mention that there is a manual and a CD available on that test on how to do it and what the results mean and how to interpret. And if you look at the Weber Training website, in the catalog area, or if you send an email to me, I can get you information on that. Thank you to all of you, and Jason, a special thanks to you for a great presentation, and I hope we'll look forward to more of the same in the future. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure for the opportunity.
And to all, we'll talk again very soon. Goodbye.